discipline of their camp, that not an apple was gathered from the tree, not a path could be traced in the fields of corn. Belisarius was chaste and sober, and the license of a military life, none could boast that they had seen him intoxicated with wine. The most beautiful captives of Gothic or Vandal race were offered to his embraces. But he turned aside from their charms, and the husband of Antonina was never suspected of violating the laws of conjugal fidelity. The spectator and historian of his exploits has observed that amidst the perils of war, he was daring without rashness, prudent without fear, slow or rapid according to the exigencies of the moment, that in the deepest distress he was animated by real or apparent hope, but that he was modest and humble in the most prosperous fortune. By these virtues he equaled or excelled the ancient masters of the military art. Victory by sea and land attended his arms. He subdued Africa, Italy, and the adjacent islands, led away captives the successors of Genseric and Theodoric, filled Constantinople with the spoils of their palaces, and in the space of 6 years recovered half the provinces of the Western Empire. In his fame and merit, in wealth and power, he remained without a rival, the first of the Roman subjects. The voice of envy could only magnify his dangerous importance, and the emperor might applaud his own discerning spirit, which had discovered and raised the genius of Belisarius. It was the custom of the Roman triumphs that a slave should be placed behind the chariot to remind the conqueror of the instability of fortune and the infirmities of human nature. Procopius, in his Anecdotes, has assumed that servile and ungrateful office. The generous reader may cast away the libel, but the evidence of facts will adhere to his memory, and he will reluctantly confess that the fame and even the virtue of Belisarius were polluted by the lust and cruelty of his wife, and that hero deserved an appellation which may not drop from the pen of the decent historian. The mother of Antonina was a theatrical prostitute, and both her father and grandfather exercised at Thessalonica and Constantinople the vile, though lucrative, profession of charioteers. In the various situations of their fortune, she became the companion, the enemy, the servant, and the favorite of the Empress Theodora. These loose and ambitious females had been connected by similar pleasures. They were separated by the jealousy of vice, and at length reconciled by the partnership of guilt. Before her marriage with Belisarius, Antonina had one husband and many lovers. Photius, the son of her former nuptials, was of an age to distinguish himself at the siege of Naples, and it was not till the autumn of her age and beauty that she indulged a scandalous attachment to a Thracian youth. Theodosius had been educated in the Eunomian heresy. The African voyage was consecrated by the baptism and auspicious name of the first soldier who embarked, and the proselyte was adopted into the family of his spiritual parents, Belisarius and Antonina. Before they touched the shores of Africa, this holy kindred degenerated into sensual love. And as Antonina soon overleaped the bounds of modesty and caution, the Roman general was alone ignorant of his own dishonor. During their residence at Carthage, he surprised the two lovers in a subterraneous chamber, solitary, warm, and almost naked. Anger flashed from his eyes. "With the help of this young man," said the unblushing Antonina, "I was secreting our most precious effects from the knowledge of Justinian." The youth resumed his garments, and the pious husband consented to disbelieve the evidence of his own senses. From this pleasing and perhaps voluntary delusion, Belisarius was awakened at Syracuse by the officious information of Macedonia, and that female attendant, after requiring an oath for her security, produced two chamberlains who, like herself, had often beheld the adulteries of Antonina. A hasty flight into Asia saved Theodosius from the justice of an injured husband, who had signified to one of his guards the order of his death. But the tears of Antonina, and her artful seductions, assured the credulous hero of her innocence, and he stooped against his faith and judgment to abandon those imprudent friends who had presumed to accuse or doubt the chastity of his wife. The revenge of a guilty woman is implacable and bloody. The unfortunate Macedonia, with the two witnesses, were secretly arrested by the minister of her cruelty. Their tongues were cut out, their bodies were hacked into small pieces, and their remains were cast into the Sea of Syracuse. A rash though judicious saying of Constantine, "I would sooner have punished the adulteress than the boy," was deeply remembered by Antonina. And 2 years afterwards, when despair had armed that officer against his general, her sanguinary advice decided and hastened his execution. Even the indignation of Photius was not forgiven by his mother. The exile of her son prepared the recall of her lover, and Theodosius condescended to accept the pressing and humble invitation of the conqueror of Italy. In the absolute direction of his household, and in the important commissions of peace and war, the favorite youth most rapidly acquired a fortune of 400,000 pounds sterling, and after their return to Constantinople, the passion of Antonina, at least, continued ardent and unabated. But fear, devotion, and lassitude perhaps inspired Theodosius with more serious thoughts. He dreaded the busy scandal of the capital and the indiscreet fondness of the wife of Belisarius. Escape from her embraces and retiring to Ephesus shaved his head and took refuge in the sanctuary of a monastic life. The despair of the new Ariadne could scarcely have been excused by the death of her husband. She wept, she tore her hair, she filled the palace with her cries. She had lost the dearest of friends, a tender, a faithful, a laborious friend. But her warm entreaties, fortified by the prayers of Belisarius, were insufficient to draw the holy monk from the solitude of Ephesus. It was not till the general moved forward for the Persian War that Theodosius could be tempted to return to Constantinople. And the short interval before the departure of Antonina herself was boldly devoted to love and pleasure. A philosopher may pity and forgive the infirmities of female nature, from which he receives no real injury. But contemptible is the husband who feels and yet endures his own infamy in that of his wife. Antonina pursued her son with implacable hatred, and the gallant Photius was exposed to her secret persecutions in the camp beyond the Tigris. Enraged by his own wrongs and by the dishonor of his blood, he cast away in his turn the sentiments of nature, and revealed to Belisarius the turpitude of a woman who had violated all the duties of a mother and a wife. From the surprise and indignation of the Roman general, his former credulity appears to have been sincere. He embraced the knees of the son of Antonina, adjured him to remember his obligations rather than his birth, and confirmed at the altar their holy vows of revenge and mutual defense. The dominion of Antonina was impaired by absence, and when she met her husband on his return from the Persian confines, Belisarius, in his first and transient emotions, confined her person and threatened her life. Photius was more resolved to punish and less prompt to pardon. He flew to Ephesus, extorted from a trusty eunuch of his mother the full confession of her guilt, arrested Theodosius and his treasures in the church of St. John the Apostle, and concealed his captives, whose execution was only delayed, in a secure and sequestered fortress of Cilicia. Such a daring outrage against public justice could not pass with impunity, and the cause of Antonina was espoused by the Empress, whose favor she had deserved by the recent services of the disgrace of a prefect and the exile and murder of a pope. At the end of the campaign, Belisarius was recalled. He complied, as usual, with the imperial mandate. His mind was not prepared for rebellion. His obedience, however adverse to the dictates of honour, was consonant to the wishes of his heart. And when he embraced his wife at the command, and perhaps in the presence of the empress, the tender husband was disposed to forgive or to be forgiven. The bounty of Theodora reserved for her companion a more precious favour. "I have found," she said, "my dearest patrician, a pearl of inestimable value. It has not yet been viewed by any mortal eye. But the sight and the possession of this jewel are destined for my friend." As soon as the curiosity and impatience of Antonina were kindled, the door of a bedchamber was thrown open, and she beheld her lover, whom the diligence of the eunuchs had discovered in his secret prison. Her silent wonder burst into passionate exclamations of gratitude and joy, and she named Theodora her queen, her benefactress, and her savior. The monk of Ephesus was nourished in the palace with luxury and ambition, but instead of assuming, as he was promised, the command of the Roman armies, Theodosius expired in the first fatigues of an amorous interview. The grief of Antonina could only be assuaged by the sufferings of her son. A youth of consular rank and a sickly constitution was punished, without a trial, like a malefactor and a slave. Yet such was the constancy of his mind that Photius sustained the tortures of the scourge and the rack without violating the faith which he had sworn to Belisarius. After this fruitless cruelty, the son of Antonina, while his mother feasted with the empress, was buried in her subterraneous prisons, which admitted not the distinction of night and day. He twice escaped to the most venerable sanctuaries of Constantinople, the churches of Santa Sophia and of the Virgin, but his tyrants were insensible of religion as of pity. And the helpless youth, amidst the clamours of the clergy and people, was twice dragged from the altar to the dungeon. His third attempt was more successful. At the end of 3 years, the prophet Zechariah, or some mortal friend, indicated the means of an escape. He eluded the spies and guards of the empress, reached the Holy Sepulchre of Jerusalem, embraced the profession of a monk, and the abbot Photius was employed after the death of Justinian to reconcile and regulate the churches of Egypt. The son of Antonina suffered all that an enemy can inflict. Her patient husband imposed on himself the more exquisite misery of violating his promise and deserting his friend. In the succeeding campaign, Belisarius was again sent against the Persians. He saved the East, but he offended Theodora, and perhaps the emperor himself. The malady of Justinian had countenanced the rumour of his death, and the Roman general, on the supposition of that probable event, spoke the free language of a citizen and a soldier. His colleague Buzes, who concurred in the same sentiments, lost his rank, his liberty, and his health by the persecution of the empress. But the disgrace of Belisarius was alleviated by the dignity of his own character and the influence of his wife, who might wish to humble but could not desire to ruin the partner of her fortunes. Even his removal was coloured by the assurance that the sinking state of Italy would be retrieved by the single presence of its conqueror. But no sooner had he returned, alone and defenceless, then a hostile commission was sent to the East to seize his treasures and criminate his actions. The guards and veterans who followed his private banner were distributed among the chiefs of the army, and even the eunuchs presumed to cast lots for the partition of his martial domestics. When he passed with a small and sordid retinue through the streets of Constantinople, his forlorn appearance excited the amazement and compassion of the people. Justinian and Theodora received him with cold ingratitude, the servile crowd with insolence and contempt. and in the evening he retired with trembling steps to his deserted palace. An indisposition, feigned or real, had confined Antonina to her apartment, and she walked disdainfully silent in the adjacent portico, while Belisarius threw himself on his bed and expected, in an agony of grief and terror, the death which he had so often braved under the walls of Rome. Long after sunset a messenger was announced from the Empress. He opened, with anxious curiosity, the letter which contained the sentence of his fate. "You cannot be ignorant how much you have deserved my displeasure. I am not insensible of the services of Antonina. To her merits and intercession I have granted your life and permit you to retain a part of your treasures which might be justly forfeited to the state. Let your gratitude, where it is due, be displayed not in words but in your future behavior." I know not how to believe or to relate the transports with which the hero is said to have received this ignominious pardon. He fell prostrate before his wife, he kissed the feet of his savior, and he devoutly promised to live the grateful and submissive slave of Antonina. A fine of 120,000 pounds sterling was levied on the fortunes of Belisarius. And with the office of count, or master of the royal stables, he accepted the conduct of the Italian war. At his departure from Constantinople, his friends, and even the public, were persuaded that as soon as he regained his freedom, he would renounce his dissimulation, and that his wife, Theodora, and perhaps the emperor himself, would be sacrificed to the just revenge of a virtuous rebel. Their hopes were deceived, and the unconquerable patience and loyalty of Belisarius appear either below or above the character of a man. Chapter 42. State of the Barbaric World. Establishment of the Lombards on the Danube. Tribes and inroads of the Sclavonians. Origin, empire, and embassies of the Turks. The flight of the Avars. Khosroes I, or Nushirvan, king of Persia. His prosperous reign and wars with the Romans. The Colchian or Lazic War. The Ethiopians. Part 1. Our estimate of personal merit is relative to the common faculties of mankind. The aspiring efforts of genius or virtue, either in active or speculative life, are measured not so much by their real elevation as by the height to which they ascend above the level of their age and country. And the same stature, which in a people of giants would pass unnoticed, must appear conspicuous in a race of pygmies. Leonidas and his 300 companions devoted their lives at Thermopylae, but the education of the infant, the boy, and the man had prepared and almost ensured this memorable sacrifice. And each Spartan would approve, rather than admire, an act of duty of which himself and 8,000 of his fellow citizens were equally capable. The great Pompey might inscribe on his trophies that he had defeated in battle 2 millions of enemies and reduced 1,500 cities from the Lake Maeotis to the Red Sea. But the fortune of Rome flew before his eagles. The nations were oppressed by their own fears, and the invincible legions which he commanded had been formed by the habits of conquest and the discipline of ages. In this view, the character of Belisarius may be deservedly placed above the heroes of the ancient republics. His imperfections flowed from the contagion of the times. His virtues were his own, the free gift of nature or reflection. He raised himself without a master or a rival, and so inadequate were the arms committed to his hand, that his sole advantage was derived from the pride and presumption of his adversaries. Under his command, the subjects of Justinian often deserved to be called Romans, but the unwarlike appellation of Greeks was imposed as a term of reproach by the haughty Goths, who affected to blush that they must dispute the kingdom of Italy with a nation of tragedian pantomimes and pirates. The climate of Asia has indeed been found less congenial than that of Europe to military spirit. Those populous countries were enervated by luxury, despotism, and superstition, and the monks were more expensive and more numerous than the soldiers of the East. The regular force of the empire had once amounted to 645,000 men. It was reduced in the time of Justinian to 150,000, and this number, large as it may seem, was thinly scattered over the sea and land. In Spain and Italy, in Africa and Egypt, on the banks of the Danube, the coast of the Black Sea, and the frontiers of Persia. The citizen was exhausted, yet the soldier was unpaid. His poverty was mischievously soothed by the privilege of rapine and indolence, and the tardy payments were detained and intercepted by the fraud of those agents who usurp, without courage or danger, the emoluments of war. Public and private distress recruited the armies of the state, but in the field, and still more in the presence of the enemy, their numbers were always defective. The want of national spirit was supplied by the precarious faith and disorderly service of barbarian mercenaries. Even military honor, which has often survived the loss of virtue and freedom, was almost totally extinct. The generals who were multiplied beyond the example of former times labored only to prevent the success or to sully the reputation of their colleagues, and they had been taught by experience that if merit sometimes provoked the jealousy, error or even guilt would obtain the indulgence of a gracious emperor. In such an age, the triumphs of Belisarius and afterwards of Narses shine with incomparable luster, but they are encompassed with the darkest shades of disgrace and calamity. While the lieutenant of Justinian subdued the kingdoms of the Goths and Vandals, the emperor, timid though ambitious, balanced the forces of the barbarians, fomented their divisions by flattery and falsehood, and invited by his patience and liberality the repetition of injuries. The keys of Carthage, Rome, and Ravenna were presented to their conqueror, while Antioch was destroyed by the Persians, and Justinian trembled for the safety of Constantinople. Even the Gothic victories of Belisarius were prejudicial to the state, since they abolished the important barrier of the Upper Danube which had been so faithfully guarded by Theodoric and his daughter. For the defense of Italy, the Goths evacuated Pannonia and Noricum, which they left in a peaceful and flourishing condition. The sovereignty was claimed by the Emperor of the Romans. The actual possession was abandoned to the boldness of the first invader. On the opposite banks of the Danube, the plains of Upper Hungary and the Transylvanian hills were possessed, since the death of Attila, by the tribes of the Gepidi, who respected the Gothic arms, and despised not indeed the gold of the Romans, but the secret motive of their annual subsidies. The vacant fortifications of the river were constantly occupied by these barbarians. Their standards were planted on the walls of Sirmium and Belgrade, and the ironical tone of their apology aggravated this insult on the majesty of the empire. "So extensive, O Caesar, are your dominions, so numerous are your cities, that you are continually seeking for nations to whom, either in peace or in war, you may relinquish these useless possessions. The Gepidi are your brave and faithful allies, and if they have anticipated your gifts, they have shown a just confidence in your bounty." Their presumption was excused by the mode of revenge which Justinian embraced. Instead of asserting the rights of a sovereign for the protection of his subjects, The emperor invited a strange people to invade and possess the Roman provinces between the Danube and the Alps, and the ambition of the Gepidi was checked by the rising power and fame of the Lombards. This corrupt appellation has been diffused in the 13th century by the merchants and bankers, the Italian posterity of these savage warriors. But the original name of Longobards is expressive only of the peculiar length and fashion of their beards. I am not disposed either to question or to justify their Scandinavian origin, nor to pursue the migrations of the Lombards through unknown regions and marvelous adventures. About the time of Augustus and Trajan, a ray of historic light breaks on the darkness of their antiquities, and they are discovered for the first time between the Elbe and the Oder. Fierce, beyond the example of the Germans, they delighted to propagate the tremendous belief that their heads were formed like the heads of dogs, and that they drank the blood of their enemies, whom they vanquished in battle. The smallness of their numbers was recruited by the adoption of their bravest slaves, and alone, amidst their powerful neighbors, they defended by arms their high-spirited independence. In the tempests of the north, which overwhelmed so many names and nations, this little bark of the Lombards still floated on the surface. They gradually descended towards the south and the Danube, and at the end of 400 years, they again appear with their ancient valor and renown. Their manners were not less ferocious. The assassination of a royal guest was executed in the presence and by the command of the king's daughter, who had been provoked by some words of insult and disappointed by his diminutive stature. And a tribute, the price of blood, was imposed on the Lombards by his brother, the king of the Heruli. Adversity revived a sense of moderation and justice, and the insolence of conquest was chastised by the signal defeat and irreparable dispersion of the Heruli, who were seated in the southern provinces of Poland. The victories of the Lombards recommended them to the friendship of the emperors, and at the solicitations of Justinian, they passed the Danube to reduce, according to their treaty, the cities of Noricum and the fortresses of Pannonia. But the spirit of rapine soon tempted them beyond these ample limits. They wandered along the coast of the Hadriatic as far as Dyrrachium, and presumed with familiar rudeness to enter the towns and houses of their Roman allies, and to seize the captives who had escaped from their audacious hands. These acts of hostility, the sallies, as it might be pretended, of some loose adventurers, were disowned by the nation and excused by the emperor. But the arms of the Lombards were more seriously engaged by a contest of 30 years, which was terminated only by the extirpation of the Gepidi. The hostile nations often pleaded their cause before the throne of Constantinople, and the crafty Justinian, to whom the barbarians were almost equally odious, pronounced a partial and ambiguous sentence, and dexterously protracted the war by slow and ineffectual succors. Their strength was formidable, since the Lombards, who sent into the field several myriads of soldiers, still claimed as the weaker side the protection of the Romans. Their spirit was intrepid, yet such is the uncertainty of courage that the two armies were suddenly struck with a panic. They fled from each other, and the rival kings remained with their guards in the midst of an empty plain. A short truce was obtained, but their mutual resentment again kindled, and the remembrance of their shame rendered the next encounter more desperate and bloody. 40,000 of the barbarians perished in the decisive battle which broke the power of the Gepidi, transferred the fears and wishes of Justinian, and first displayed the character of Alboin, the youthful prince of the Lombards and the future conqueror of Italy. The wild people who dwelt or wandered in the plains of Russia, Lithuania, and Poland might be reduced in the age of Justinian under the two great families of the Bulgarians and the Sclavonians. According to the Greek writers, the former, who touched the Black Sea and the Lake Maeotis, derived from the Huns their name or descent, and it is indeed to renew the simple and well-known picture of Tatar manners. They were bold and dexterous archers, who drank the milk and feasted on the flesh of their fleet and indefatigable horses, whose flocks and herds followed, or rather guided, the motions of their roving camps, to whose inroads no country was remote or impervious, and who were practiced in flight, though incapable of fear. The nation was divided into two powerful and hostile tribes, who pursued each other with fraternal hatred. They eagerly disputed the friendship, or rather the gifts, of the emperor, and the distinctions which nature had fixed between the faithful dog and the rapacious wolf was applied by an ambassador who received only verbal instructions from the mouth of his illiterate prince. The Bulgarians, of whatsoever species, were equally attracted by Roman wealth. They assumed a vague dominion over the Sclavonian name, and their rapid marches could only be stopped by the Baltic Sea, or the extreme cold and poverty of the north. But the same race of Sclavonians appears to have maintained in every age the possession of the same countries. Their numerous tribes, however distant or adverse, used one common language. It was harsh and irregular, and were known by the resemblance of their form, which deviated from the swarthy Tartar, and approached, without attaining, the lofty stature and fair complexion of the German. 4,600 villages were scattered over the provinces of Russia and Poland, and their huts were hastily built of rough timber in a country deficient both in stone and iron. Erected, or rather concealed, in the depth of forests, on the banks of rivers or the edges of morasses, we may not, perhaps without flattery, compare them to the architecture of the beaver, which they resembled in a double issue, to the land and water, for the escape of the savage inhabitant, an animal less cleanly, less diligent, and less social than that marvelous quadruped. The fertility of the soil rather than the labor of the natives supply the rustic plenty of the Sclavonians. Their sheep and horned cattle were large and numerous, and the fields which they sowed with millet or panic afforded in place of bread a coarse and less nutritive food. The incessant rapine of their neighbors compelled them to bury this treasure in the earth. But on the appearance of a stranger, it was freely imparted by a people whose unfavorable character is qualified by the epithets of chaste, patient, and hospitable. As their supreme god, they adored an invisible master of the thunder. The rivers and the nymphs obtained their subordinate honors, and the popular worship was expressed in vows and sacrifice. These Sclavonians disdained to obey a despot, a prince, or even a magistrate, but their experience was too narrow, their passions too headstrong to compose a system of equal law or general defense. Some voluntary respect was yielded to age and valor, but each tribe or village existed as a separate republic, and all must be persuaded where none could be compelled. They fought on foot, almost naked, and except an unwieldy shield, without any defensive armor. Their weapons of offense were a bow, a quiver of small poisoned arrows, and a long rope, which they dexterously threw from a distance and entangled their enemy in a running noose. In the field, the Sclavonian infantry was dangerous by their speed, agility, and hardiness. They swam, they dived, they remained underwater, drawing their breath through a hollow cane, and a river or lake was often the scene of their unsuspected ambuscade. But these were the achievements of spies or stragglers. The military art was unknown to these Sclavonians. Their name was obscure, and their conquests were inglorious. I have marked the faint and general outline of the Sclavonians and Bulgarians without attempting to define their intermediate boundaries, which were not accurately known or respected by the barbarians themselves. Their importance was measured by their vicinity to the empire, and the level country of Moldavia and Wallachia was occupied by the Antis, a Sclavonian tribe which swelled the titles of Justinian with an epithet of conquest. Against the Antes he erected the fortifications of the lower Danube, and labored to secure the alliance of a people seated in the direct channel of northern inundation, an interval of 200 miles between the mountains of Transylvania and the Black Sea. But the Antes wanted power, and inclination to stem the fury of the torrent, and the light-armed Sclavonians from 100 tribes pursued with almost equal speed the footsteps of the Bulgarian horse. The payment of 1 piece of gold for each soldier procured a safe and easy retreat through the country of the Gepidi, who commanded the passage of the Upper Danube. The hopes or fears of the barbarians, their intense union or discord, the accident of a frozen or shallow stream, the prospect of harvest or vintage, the prosperity or distress of the Romans, were the causes which produced the uniform repetition of annual visits, tedious in the narrative and destructive in the event. The same year, and possibly the same month in which Ravenna surrendered, was marked by an invasion of the Huns or Bulgarians, so dreadful that it almost effaced the memory of their past inroads. They spread from the suburbs of Constantinople to the Ionian Gulf, destroyed 32 cities or castles, erased Potidaea, which Athens had built and Philip had besieged, and repassed the Danube, dragging at their horses' heels 120,000 of the subjects of Justinian. In a subsequent inroad, they pierced the wall of the Thracian Chersonesus, extirpated the habitations and the inhabitants, boldly traversed the Hellespont, and returned to their companions, laden with the spoils of Asia. Another party, which seemed a multitude in the eyes of the Romans, penetrated without opposition from the Straits of Thermopylae to the Isthmus of Corinth, and the last ruin of Greece has appeared an object too minute for the attention of history. The works which the emperor raised for the protection, but at the expense of his subjects, served only to disclose the weakness of some neglected part, and the walls, which by flattery had been deemed impregnable, were either deserted by the garrison or scaled by the barbarians. 3,000 Sclavonians, who insolently divided themselves into 2 bands, discovered the weakness and misery of a triumphant reign. They passed the Danube and the Hebrus, vanquished the Roman generals who dared to oppose their progress, and plundered with impunity the cities of Illyricum and Thrace, each of which had arms and numbers to overwhelm their contemptible assailants. Whatever praise the boldness of the Sclavonians may deserve, it is sullied by the wanton and deliberate cruelty which they are accused of exercising on their prisoners. Without distinction of rank or age or sex, the captives were impaled or flayed alive or suspended between 4 posts, and beaten with clubs till they expired, or enclosed in some spacious building and left to perish in the flames with the spoil and cattle which might impede the march of these savage victors. Perhaps a more impartial narrative would reduce the number and qualify the nature of these horrid acts, and they might sometimes be excused by the cruel laws of retaliation. In the siege of Tapirus, whose obstinate defense had enraged the Sclavonians, they massacred 15,000 males, but they spared the women and children. The most valuable captives were always reserved for labor or ransom. The servitude was not rigorous, and the terms of their deliverance were speedy and moderate. But the subject, or the historian of Justinian, exhaled his just indignation in the language of complaint and reproach. And Procopius has confidently affirmed that in a reign of 32 years, each annual inroad of the barbarians consumed 200,000 of the inhabitants of the Roman Empire. The entire population of Turkish Europe, which nearly corresponds with the provinces of Justinian, would perhaps be incapable of supplying 6 millions of persons, the result of this incredible estimate. In the midst of these obscure calamities, Europe felt the shock of revolution, which first revealed to the world the name and nation of the Turks. Unlike Romulus, the founder of that martial people was suckled by a she-wolf, who afterwards made him the father of a numerous progeny, and the representation of that animal in the banners of the Turks preserved the memory, or rather suggested the idea, of a fable which was invented without any mutual intercourse by the shepherds of Latium and those of Scythia. At the equal distance of 2,000 miles from the Caspian, the Icy, the Chinese, and the Bengal Seas, a ridge of mountains is conspicuous, the center and perhaps the summit of Asia, which in the language of different nations has been styled Emmaus, and Kaf, and Altai, and the Golden Mountains, and the Girdle of the Earth. The sides of the hills were productive of minerals, and the iron forges for the purposes of war were exercised by the Turks, the most despised portion of the slaves of the great Khan of the Gyugin. But their servitude could only last till a leader, bold and eloquent, should arise to persuade his countrymen that the same arms which they forged for their masters might become in their own hands the instruments of freedom and victory. They sallied from the mountains. A scepter was the reward of his advice, and the annual ceremony in which a piece of iron was heated in the fire and a smith's hammer was successively handled by the prince and his nobles recorded for ages the humble profession and rational pride of the Turkish nation. Betezena, their first leader, signalized their valor and his own in successful combats against the neighboring tribes. But when he presumed to ask in marriage the daughter of the great Khan, the insolent demand of a slave and a mechanic was contemptuously rejected. The disgrace was expiated by a more noble alliance with the princess of China, and the decisive battle which almost extirpated the nation of the Gyugin established in Tartary the new and more powerful empire of the Turks. They reigned over the north, but they confessed the vanity of conquest by their faithful attachment to the mountain of their fathers. The royal encampment seldom lost sight of Mount Altai, from whence the river Irtysh descends to water the rich pastures of the Kalmucks, which nourish the largest sheep and oxen in the world. The soil is fruitful, and the climate mild and temperate. The happy region was ignorant of earthquake and pestilence. The emperor's throne was turned towards the east, and a golden wolf on the top of a spear seemed to guard the entrance of his tent. One of the successors of Betezena was tempted by the luxury and superstition of China, but his design of building cities and temples was defeated by the simple wisdom of a barbarian counselor. "The Turks," he said, "are not equal in number to 100th part of the inhabitants of China. If we balance their power and elude their armies, it is because we wander without any fixed habitations in the exercise of war and hunting. Are we strong? We advance and conquer. Are we feeble? We retire and are concealed. Should the Turks confine themselves within the walls of cities, the loss of a battle would be the destruction of their empire. The Bonzes preach only patience, humility, and the renunciation of the world. Such, O king, is not the religion of heroes." They entertained with less reluctance the doctrines of Zoroaster, but the greatest part of the nation acquiesced without inquiry in the opinions, or rather in the practice, of their ancestors. The honors of sacrifice were reserved for the supreme deity. They acknowledged in rude hymns their obligations to the air, the fire, the water, and the earth, and their priests derived some profit from the art of divination. Their unwritten laws were rigorous and impartial. Theft was punished with a tenfold restitution, adultery, treason, and murder with death, and no chastisement could be inflicted too severe for the rare and inexpiable guilt of cowardice. As the subject nations marched under the standard of the Turks, their cavalry, both men and horses, were proudly computed by millions. One of their effective armies consisted of 400,000 soldiers, and in less than 50 years they were connected in peace and war with the Romans, the Persians, and the Chinese. In their northern limits, some vestige may be discovered of the form and situation of Kamchatka, of a people of hunters and fishermen whose sledges were drawn by dogs, and whose habitations were buried in the earth. The Turks were ignorant of astronomy, but the observation taken by some learned Chinese, with a gnomon of 8 feet, fixes the royal camp in the latitude of 49 degrees, and marks their extreme progress within 3, or at least 10 degrees, of the polar circle. Among their southern conquests, the most splendid was that of the Hephthalites, or White Huns, a polite and warlike people who possessed the commercial cities of Bukhara and Samarkand, who had vanquished the Persian monarch and carried their victorious arms along the banks and perhaps to the mouth of the Indus. On the side of the west, the Turkish cavalry advanced to the Lake Myotis. They passed that lake on the ice. The Khan, who dwelt at the foot of Mount Altai, issued his commands for the siege of Bosphorus, a city the voluntary subject of Rome, and whose princes had formerly been the friends of Athens. To the east the Turks invaded China, as often as the vigour of the government was relaxed, and I am taught to read in the history of the times that they mowed down their patient enemies like hemp or grass, and that the mandarins applauded the wisdom of an emperor who repulsed these barbarians with golden lances. This extent of savage empire compelled the Turkish monarch to establish 3 subordinate princes of his own blood, who soon forgot their gratitude and allegiance. The conquerors were enervated by luxury, which is always fatal, except to an industrious people. The policy of China solicited the vanquished nations to resume their independence, and the power of the Turks was limited to a period of 200 years. The revival of their name and dominion in the southern countries of Asia are the events of a later age, and the dynasties which succeeded to their native realms may sleep in oblivion, since their history bears no relation to the decline and fall of the Roman Empire. Part 2. In the rapid career of conquest, the Turks attacked and subdued the nation of the Uyghurs, or Varkanites, on the banks of the river Til, which derived the epithet of black from its dark water or gloomy forests. The Khan of the Uyghurs was slain with 300,000 of his subjects, and their bodies were scattered over the space of 4 days' journey. Their surviving countrymen acknowledged the strength and mercy of the Turks, and a small portion, about 20,000 warriors, preferred exile to servitude. They followed the well-known road of the Volga, cherished the error of the nations who confounded them with the Avars, and spread the terror of that false, though famous, appellation, which had not, however, saved its lawful proprietors from the yoke of the Turks. After a long and victorious march, the new Avars arrived at the foot of Mount Caucasus, in the country of the Alani and Circassians, where they first heard of the splendor and weakness of the Roman Empire. They humbly requested their confederate, the Prince of the Alani, to lead them to this source of riches, and their ambassador, with the permission of the governor of Lazica, was transported by the Black Sea to Constantinople. The whole city was poured forth to behold with curiosity and terror the aspect of a strange people. Their long hair, which hung in tresses down their backs, was gracefully bound with ribbons, but the rest of their habit appeared to imitate the fashion of the Huns. When they were admitted to the audience of Justinian, Candish, the first of the ambassadors, addressed the Roman emperor in these terms: "You see before you, O mighty prince, the representatives of the strongest and most populous of nations, the invincible, the irresistible Avars. We are willing to devote ourselves to your service. We are able to vanquish and destroy all the enemies who now disturb your repose. But we expect, as the price of our alliance, as the reward of our valor, precious gifts, annual subsidies, and fruitful possessions." At the time of this embassy, Justinian had reigned above 30, he had lived above 75 years. His mind, as well as his body, was feeble and languid, and the conqueror of Africa and Italy careless of the permanent interest of his people, aspired only to end his days in the bosom even of inglorious peace. In a studied oration he imparted to the Senate his resolution to dissemble the insult and to purchase the friendship of the Avars, and the whole Senate, like the mandarins of China, applauded the incomparable wisdom and foresight of their sovereign. The instruments of luxury were immediately prepared to captivate the barbarians. Silken garments, soft and splendid beds, and chains and collars encrusted with gold. The ambassadors, content with such liberal reception, departed from Constantinople, and Valentin, one of the emperor's guards, was sent with a similar character to their camp at the foot of Mount Caucasus. As their destruction or their success must be alike advantageous to the empire, he persuaded them to invade the enemies of Rome, and they were easily tempted by gifts and promises to gratify their ruling inclinations. These fugitives, who fled before the Turkish arms, passed the Tanais and Borysthenes, and boldly advanced into the heart of Poland and Germany, violating the law of nations and abusing the rights of victory. Before 10 years had elapsed, their camps were seated on the Danube and the Elbe. Many Bulgarian and Sclavonian names were obliterated from the earth, and the remainder of their tribes are found as tributaries and vassals under the standard of the Avars. The Chagan, the peculiar title of their king, still affected to cultivate the friendship of the emperor, and Justinian entertained some thoughts of fixing them in Pannonia to balance the prevailing power of the Lombards. But the virtue or treachery of an Avar betrayed the secret enmity and ambitious designs of their countrymen, and they loudly complained of the timid, though jealous, policy of detaining their ambassadors and denying the arms which they had been allowed to purchase in the capital of the empire. Perhaps the apparent change in the dispositions of the emperors may be ascribed to the embassy which was received from the conquerors of the Avars. The immense distance which eluded their arms could not extinguish their resentment. The Turkish ambassadors pursued the footsteps of the vanquished to the Jaik, the Volga, Mount Caucasus, the Black Sea, and Constantinople, and at length appeared before the successor of Constantine to request that he would not espouse the cause of rebels and fugitives. Even commerce had some share in this remarkable negotiation, and the Sogdoites, who were now the tributaries of the Turks, embraced the fair occasion of opening, by the north of the Caspian, a new road for the importation of Chinese silk into the Roman Empire. The Persian, who preferred the navigation of Ceylon, had stopped the caravans of Bukhara and Samarkand. Their silk was contemptuously burnt. Some Turkish ambassadors died in Persia with a suspicion of poison, and the great Khan permitted his faithful vassal, Maniak, the prince of the Sogdoites, to propose at the Byzantine court a treaty of alliance against their common enemies. Their splendid apparel and rich presents, the fruit of Oriental luxury, distinguished Maniak and his colleagues from the rude savages of the north. Their letters, in the Scythian character and language, announced a people who had attained the rudiments of science. They enumerated the conquests, they offered the friendship and military aid of the Turks, and their sincerity was attested by direful imprecations, if they were guilty of falsehood, against their own head and the head of Disabul, their master. The Greek prince entertained with hospitable regard the ambassadors of a remote and powerful monarch. The sight of silkworms and looms disappointed the hopes of the Sogdoites. The emperor renounced, or seemed to renounce, the fugitive Avars, but he accepted the alliance of the Turks, and the ratification of the treaty was carried by a Roman minister to the foot of Mount Altai. Under the successors of Justinian, the friendship of the two nations was cultivated by frequent and cordial intercourse. The most favored vassals were permitted to imitate the example of the great Khan, and 106 Turks, who on various occasions had visited Constantinople, departed at the same time for their native country. The duration and length of the journey from the Byzantine court to Mount Altai are not specified. It might have been difficult to mark a road through the nameless deserts, the mountains, rivers, and morasses of Tartary. But a curious account has been preserved of the reception of the Roman ambassadors at the royal camp. After they had been purified with fire and incense, according to a rite still practiced under the sons of Genghis, they were introduced to the presence of Disabul. In a valley of the Golden Mountain, they found the great Khan in his tent, seated in a chair with wheels, to which a horse might be occasionally harnessed. As soon as they had delivered their presents, which were received by the proper officers, they exposed, in a florid oration, the wishes of the Roman Emperor that victory might attend the arms of the Turks, that their reign might be long and prosperous, and that a strict alliance, without envy or deceit, might forever be maintained between the two most powerful nations of the earth. The answer of Disabul corresponded with these friendly professions, and the ambassadors were seated by his side at a banquet which lasted the greatest part of the day. The tent was surrounded with silk hangings, and a Tartar liquor was served on the table, which possessed at least the intoxicating qualities of wine. The entertainment of the day was more sumptuous. The silk hangings of the second tent were embroidered in various figures, and the royal seat, the cups, and the vases were of gold. A third pavilion was supported by columns of gilt wood. A bed of pure and massy gold was raised on four peacocks of the same metal, and before the entrance of the tent, dishes, basins, and statues of solid silver and admirable art were ostentatiously piled in wagons, the monuments of valor rather than of industry. When Disabul led his armies against the frontiers of Persia, his Roman allies followed many days the march of the Turkish camp, nor were they dismissed till they had enjoyed their precedency over the envoy of the great king, whose loud and intemperate clamours interrupted the silence of the royal banquet. The power and ambition of Khosroes cemented the union of the Turks and Romans, who touched his dominions on either side. But those distant nations, regardless of each other, consulted the dictates of interest without recollecting the obligations of oaths and treaties. While the successor of Disabul celebrated his father's obsequies, he was saluted by the ambassadors of the Emperor Tiberius, who proposed an invasion of Persia, and sustained, with firmness, the angry and perhaps the just reproaches of that haughty barbarian. "You see my 10 fingers," said the great Khan, and he applied them to his mouth. "You Romans speak with as many tongues, but they are tongues of deceit and perjury. To me you hold one language, to my subjects another, and the nations are successively deluded by your perfidious eloquence. You precipitate your allies into war and danger. You enjoy their labors, and you neglect your benefactors." Hasten your return. Inform your master that a Turk is incapable of uttering or forgiving falsehood, and that he shall speedily meet the punishment which he deserves. While he solicits my friendship with flattering and hollow words, he is sunk to a confederate of my fugitive Varkanites. If I condescend to march against those contemptible slaves, they will tremble at the sound of our whips. They will be trampled like a nest of ants under the feet of my innumerable cavalry. I am not ignorant of the road which they have followed to invade your empire, nor can I be deceived by the vain pretense that Mount Caucasus is the impregnable barrier of the Romans. I know the course of the Dniester, the Danube, and the Hebrus. The most warlike nations have yielded to the arms of the Turks, and from the rising to the setting sun, the earth is my inheritance. Notwithstanding this menace, a sense of mutual advantage soon renewed the alliance of the Turks and Romans. But the pride of the great Khan survived his resentment, and when he announced an important conquest to his friend the Emperor Maurice, he styled himself the master of the 7 races and the lord of the 7 climates of the world. Disputes have often arisen between the sovereigns of Asia for the title of King of the World, while the contest has proved that it could not belong to either of the competitors. The kingdom of the Turks was bounded by the Oxus, or Gihon, and Turan was separated by that great river from the rival monarchy of Iran, or Persia, which in a smaller compass contained perhaps a larger measure of power and population. The Persians, who alternately invaded and repulsed the Turks and the Romans, were still ruled by the House of Sasan, which ascended the throne 300 years before the accession of Justinian. His contemporary, Kabades, or Kobad, had been successful in war against the Emperor Anastasius, but the reign of that prince was distracted by civil and religious troubles. A prisoner in the hands of his subjects, an exile among the enemies of Persia, he recovered his liberty by prostituting the honor of his wife, and regained his kingdom with the dangerous and mercenary aid of the barbarians who had slain his father. His nobles were suspicious that Kobad never forgave the authors of his expulsion, or even those of his restoration. The people was deluded and inflamed by the fanaticism of Mazdak, who asserted the community of women and the equality of mankind, whilst he appropriated the richest lands and most beautiful females to the use of his sectaries. The view of these disorders, which had been fomented by his laws and example, embittered the declining age of the Persian monarch, and his fears were increased by the consciousness of his designs to reverse the natural and customary order of succession in favor of his third and most favored son, so famous under the names of Khosroes and Nushirvan. To render the youth more illustrious in the eyes of the nations, Kobad was desirous that he should be adopted by the Emperor Justin. The hope of peace inclined the Byzantine court to accept this singular proposal, and Khosroes might have acquired a specious claim to the inheritance of his Roman parent. But the future mischief was diverted by the advice of the quaestor Proclus. A difficulty was started, whether the adoption should be performed as a civil or military rite. The treaty was abruptly dissolved, and the sense of this indignity sunk deep into the mind of Khosroes, who had already advanced to the Tigris on his road to Constantinople. His father did not long survive the disappointment of his wishes. The testament of their deceased sovereign was read in the assembly of the nobles, and a powerful faction, prepared for the event and regardless of the priority of age, exalted Khosroes to the throne of Persia. He filled that throne during a prosperous period of 48 years, and the justice of Nushirvan is celebrated as the theme of immortal praise by the nations of the East. But the justice of kings is understood by themselves and even by their subjects with an ample indulgence for the gratification of passion and interest. The virtue of Khosroes was that of a conqueror, who in the measures of peace and war is excited by ambition and restrained by prudence, who confounds the greatness with the happiness of a nation, and calmly devotes the lives of thousands to the fame or even the amusement of a single man. In his domestic administration, the just Nushirvan would merit in our feelings the appellation of a tyrant. His two elder brothers had been deprived of their fair expectations of the diadem. Their future life, between the supreme rank and the condition of subjects, was anxious to themselves and formidable to their master. Fear, as well as revenge, might tempt them to rebel. The slightest evidence of a conspiracy satisfied the author of their wrongs, and the repose of Khosroes was secured by the death of these unhappy princes with their families and adherents. One guiltless youth was saved and dismissed by the compassion of a veteran general, and this act of humanity, which was revealed by his son, overbalanced the merit of reducing 12 nations to the obedience of Persia. The zeal and prudence of Mebudes had fixed the diadem on the head of Khosroes himself, but he delayed to attend the royal summons till he had performed the duties of a military review. He was instantly commanded to repair to the iron tripod, which stood before the gate of the palace, where it was death to relieve or approach the victim. And Mabodes languished several days before his sentence was pronounced by the inflexible pride and calm ingratitude of the son of Kobad. But the people, more especially in the East, is disposed to forgive and even to applaud the cruelty which strikes at the loftiest heads, at the slaves of ambition whose voluntary choice has exposed them to live in the smiles and to perish by the frown of a capricious monarch. In the execution of the laws which he had no temptation to violate, in the punishment of crimes which attacked his own dignity as well as the happiness of individuals, Nushirvan, or Khosroes, deserved the appellation of just. His government was firm, rigorous, and impartial. It was the first labor of his reign to abolish the dangerous theory of common or equal possessions. The lands and women which the sectaries of Mazdak has usurped were restored to their lawful owners, and the temperate chastisement of the fanatics or impostors confirmed the domestic rights of society. Instead of listening with blind confidence to a favorite minister, he established four viziers over the four great provinces of his empire, Assyria, Media, Persia, and Bactriana. In the choice of judges, prefects, and counselors, he strove to remove the mask which is always worn in the presence of kings. He wished to substitute the natural order of talents for the accidental distinctions of birth and fortune. He professed in specious language his intention to prefer those men who carried the poor in their bosoms and to banish corruption from the seat of justice, as dogs were excluded from the temples of the Magi. The code of laws of the first Artaxerxes was revived and published as the rule of the magistrates, but the assurance of speedy punishment was the best security of their virtue. Their behavior was inspected by a thousand eyes. Their words were overheard by a thousand ears, the secret or public agents of the throne. And the provinces, from the Indian to the Arabian confines, were enlightened by the frequent visits of a sovereign who affected to emulate his celestial brother in his rapid and salutary career. Education and agriculture he viewed as the two objects most deserving of his care. In every city of Persia, orphans and the children of the poor were maintained and instructed at the public expense. The daughters were given in marriage to the richest citizens of their own rank, and the sons, according to their different talents, were employed in mechanic trades or promoted to more honorable service. The deserted villages were relieved by his bounty. To the peasants and farmers who were found incapable of cultivating their lands, he distributed cattle, seed, and the instruments of husbandry, and the rare and inestimable treasure of fresh water was parsimoniously managed and skillfully dispersed over the arid territory of Persia. The prosperity of that kingdom was the effect and evidence of his virtues. His vices are those of Oriental despotism. But in the long competition between Khosroes and Justinian, the advantage both of merit and fortune is almost always on the side of the barbarian. To the praise of justice, Nushirvan united the reputation of knowledge, and the seven Greek philosophers who visited his court were invited and deceived by the strange assurance that a disciple of Plato was seated on the Persian throne. Did they expect that a prince strenuously exercised in the toils of war and government should agitate with dexterity like their own the abstruse and profound questions which amused the leisure of the schools of Athens? Could they hope that the precepts of philosophy should direct the life and control the passions of a despot whose infancy had been taught to consider his absolute and fluctuating will as the only rule of moral obligation? The studies of Khosroes were ostentatious.